Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. Boy, it just feels like these mundane bills here. It's just a different vibe. We're going to start a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2022. Representative Nierman, did you want to testify on this? You're okay. Well, let's get a briefing here from Mazen. And getting to
Mazen's an expert on cement mixers in here.
Metric. He's been working on the transportation plan, so he knows what cement is.
So the bill comes to you from two committees on the House, Transportation first and then House Revenue. And the volumetric mixers that this bill deals with is basically trying to adjust the definition of what a fixed load vehicle. It seems the issue started with some assessors thinking that this type of equipment is subject to property tax because it is an equipment and a personal property, and thus does not meet the exemption that otherwise is in the law. And this bill tries to make that exemption more pronounced in its legal format. That is the problem that we're trying to fix, Mr. Chair.
That's the problem we're trying to fix. Okay, any questions of Mazen? We do have Representative Lively. Would you like to? You're not on this bill. Okay. We do have some people signed up here to testify. Rich Angstrom, you want to bring your team up? Josh Oat, Carly Schoat.
I changed my mind.
You changed your mind?
So Rich talked me into it.
So thank you, Chair Hawes. For the record, my name is Mike Nierman. I'm State Representative from House District 23, or the House District from 99W, as I describe it sometimes. Anyway, this I'm not really an expert on this bill here. It's got bipartisan support. I was glad to sponsor this with my friend Representative Evans and Representative Malmstrom, and it passed the House unanimously. And I think it's a small fix that's needed. But I'll let the expert give the testimony on it.
Good morning. My name is Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association, affectionately known in the building as OCAFA. I'm going to walk through just a real short presentation because this is kind of a convoluted statute, and to understand what we're trying to do here, I found it easier just to do a short presentation on it. So, introducing a volumetric mixer. It's different than a transit mixer, which has the big drum. And basically the difference is all the materials are held separately. The water, cement, and the aggregates are held separately. And when they get out to the site, then they're mixed together. Versus a transit mixer where the drum's turning around the whole time, the concrete's mixing as the truck goes down the road. And the bill does two things. It essentially changes the fixed load vehicle statute so volumetric mixers fall under the same category as transit mixers for purposes of taxation. What I'm trying to do with this bill is make sure the big folks like the Knife Rivers and the little tiny folks, which are our volumetric mixer guys, have the same tax structure so they're competing at the same level on the based on taxes. The other thing it does is it changes some words within the statute, just some general cleanup. The statute currently uses the word cement in places where it should be using concrete, and I will show you that they are actually two different things. And so it's a bill that everybody kind of wins. It clarifies the statute. Concrete is made 6% air, 11% Portland cement, 41% gravel and crushed stone, 26% sand, and 16% water. And because of aggregates absorb water differently, the aggregate water ratio may change a little bit, and that's why there's various mixed designs on concrete. But as you can see, one of the products within concrete is cement, so you can't really have cement batch plants and cement things of that nature. They don't exist, and we're changing that so the statute actually reflects the right terminology. So there I say the treats a concrete delivery truck similar under Oregon laws and taxation rules, creates competitive fairness across all types of concrete delivery trucks, and then eliminates cement mixer, cement batch plant, cement pavers. Those things don't exist at all. They are concrete mixers, concrete batch plants, and concrete paving finishers. So that's a transit mixer. So I'm just a little education. You can see that's got a big drum. It turns. I think that's a green and white out of the Corvallis area truck. This is a nationwide a volumetric mixer, and this is nationwide in Eugene. And you can see, again, concrete's coming out of the back end of the truck. Basically, the materials are held separately, and they run through an auger system. And once they go through that auger system, right at the end of the process, out comes the concrete, which is different, whole different way of mixing concrete. And the reason we thought we ended up with a problem with this was one of the companies decided to name his company's name Mobile Mix Concrete. And included in the statute itself is the word mix mobile. And somebody thought, well, that's probably what it meant. And we think may not, and so instead of basically having a conversation and, you know, challenging it up through the court systems, because we thought it's just easier to fix it in statute, because the statute needed to be fixed in a number of other ways. So that's really kind of how the whole issue got started. There on the far right hand side, you can kind of see the back end of one of these things, where that whole back end is how it's mixed. That's the auger system, and you can see all the controls and stuff as they let out the various materials. It's a pretty interesting process, and it's not a very easy delivery system. I mean, the truck drivers really got to know what they do. It's a skilled job to be able to handle one of these trucks. I did want you to see what is tax as an ad valorem tax. This is a mobile concrete batch facility. And this is the kind of plant that would be taxed as for property tax purposes, an ad valorem tax, even though it has wheels. But the primary purpose is to move the equipment out to a job site that then gets set up, and that is subject to county taxes. Another example would be this facility, which is another concrete batch facility. You can see the truck pulling under there. I'm not sure what company that is there, but that would also be taxed as a ad valorem tax. So here's the point. Both deliver concrete. There you see. They're exactly the same coming out. They can even do the same mix designs. What's interesting about these trucks, just as a quick couple of sides, is they are heavily used for roads and getting into smaller places. By keeping the material separate, they're able to go greater haul distances and deliver the material than a transit mixer. A transit mixer ranges kind of like 30 miles or so. And in fact, it only has so many rotations you can do, because the material starts separating out into the drum itself. But the nice thing about these volumetric mixers, as you can see the one in that far right-hand part of this slide, is they can go as far as you want, because all the materials are separated. And it should be no surprise that after a very short period of time, concrete does one thing. It's perishable. It sets up, and you don't want it to set up inside your concrete truck. So we are limited a little bit on distance. But here's we do all kinds of things with these kinds of trucks. Here is a bus pad on 82nd Avenue in Portland. Here's another bridge deck on the Nakanakum. This one actually shows our ability to reach out and get to a further range, because that bridge deck in Nakanakum is quite a ways from the nearest transit mix location. Another bridge deck on I-5 overpass in Woodburn was done with a volumetric mixer. That's actually a transit mixer, a different style of transit mixer owned by Knife River, and I'm guessing that's a circle in Bend, one of the circles they put in the Bend area. What does it say there? Doesn't say it. Anyway. So the conclusion here is we're fixing the fixed load vehicle statute. We're treating all the similar trucks similarly under the tax statutes, and we're trying to allow competitive fairness for my smallest members for our association. And that concludes my testimony. Just a little primer on concrete and concrete trucks.
Thank you. Questions?
session with a few more people to testify. Thank you both, representatives. I do have the Schoats. Did you guys want to weigh in? And I have Ruth Tuttle. Did you want to come up and testify?
No, thank you. We signed our own.
Covered. Okay. He did a pretty good job. So we have no one in opposition to this.
Mr. We're in work session.
We are in
Mr.
work
Chair,
session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2022 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2022 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bertier.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yep.
Pass votes aye. House Bill 2022 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Bertschiger, this is big trucks and cement and part of your world. Would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
All right. Bertschiger will carry. I'll close out
that
work session. Yeah.
You have a list?
Open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 24-7. Kyle, if you could give us a quick summary.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 24-07 is making a change to what's referred to as the deferred billing credits in the property tax program. So I'll just briefly give a background on that, and then I'll briefly discuss the changes, because I know we have Rep. Lively here, and the assessors will also be discussing some of the changes and how that impacts how they issue what is now called a deferred billing credit. So the deferred billing credits came out of legislation back in 2011, House Bill 2569, and what it does is it allows a county assessor to issue what's called a deferred billing credit, and that's in cases of large value property tax disputes. And the idea here is that the amount of the disputes, the property tax imposed, that is the amount of the disputes, something that's under litigation, the county assessor will issue this deferred billing credit, and it allows the property owner in that case to, they're not required to make the payment of the taxes, rather they're giving credit for as if they did make the payment. And then once the litigation is resolved, the property owner will either be required to make that payment, or if the property owner wins in litigation, then maybe there's no requirement of property taxes being paid. But the key or part of the reason behind that was if the property owner does make the payment and then you have litigation ongoing for a number of years, and then say the litigation, the outcome is in favor of the property owner, those property tax dollars that have been collected over those number of years would have to be refunded with interest, and that could, especially in instances of large value appeals, could have a pretty could have a heavy impact on the local governments if you're talking 5, 6, maybe even 10 years of refunds all coming out at once with that interest. So that's the deferred billing credit. The change in House Bill 2407 is changing the deferred billing credit to a potential refund credit, and it still has the mechanism allowing the county assessor to identify these large value appeals and whether or not to issue the deferred billing credit. But instead, with the potential refund credit, the property tax, the property owner will be required to pay the disputed amount. That disputed amount is then put into an investment vehicle by the county treasurer, and this is going to be a short-term, very safe investment. So you're talking pretty minimal interest, 1, maybe 2% in today's climate. But those tax dollars will collect interest, and then when the outcome of the appeal, so when the litigation finally runs its course, those dollars that are sitting in the account earning interest would then be used to either, if the property owner wins the court case, they'd be used to make that refunded amount, those property taxes coming back out, or if it's ruled in favor of the county or the Department of Revenue, if they're handling the litigation, then those dollars that are sitting in the account earning interest would be used to make the payment of the property taxes once the final case is resolved. And of course, the case could be split or something like that. So those part of those dollars could be used, and part of them could be refunded. But the idea being, they're placed into account, they earn interest, and then the party that prevails in court would get those dollars back with the interest. So whether it's the property owner that prevails, they get the dollars plus the interest, or if it's the taxing districts, they get the dollars plus the interest that's accrued. And I do have some information on the the revenue impact statement. There is an opportunity for that interest amount. That's something that's not imposed or collected right now, so that could be a revenue lift, but of course it would depend upon the outcome of court case. And especially in the case of the deferred billing credits that are out there right now, most of those dollars are really coming from one court case. So any impact on revenue will really be dependent upon outstanding litigation and how it gets resolved and how long it really goes on as well, because it'll take a number of years before that interest really starts to accrue much.
How would it affect, so would it have an effect on current litigation, or is it prospective or retroactive?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, it wouldn't affect deferred billing credits that are already in place, but if you're being issued deferred billing credits on litigation that's ongoing, it would start years going forward. So if you have 8 years of deferred billing credits that have been issued, those will still be deferred billing credits, so no interest, no payment required. But in years going forward, if that litigation is still ongoing, it would start picking up those new dollars, so the new dispute amounts. So it's not retroactive, but it does start with existing litigation that could be ongoing right now today.
Okay, Representative Lively.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be all right if I have the two other people here, Doug, the assessor, and that come up just to make sure.
Sure, that'd
I've
be
got
fine.
The experts here to answer your questions.
Representative, we thought you were the expert.
I pretend to be at times, but I usually get caught up in that after I've done that, so thank you. So, Mr. Chair and Vice Chair and members of the committee, my name is John Lively. I'm State Representative from House District 12, which is Springfield. So I appreciate this time this morning to talk a little bit about House Bill 2407. And while I know none of you read the newspaper and believe what's in there, but the article that appeared after this bill passed the House was not correct on what the bill does or doesn't do, and I just want to make sure. I know the public in some cases believes that's the case, but that's not. And so it does a couple, three things. And the intent early on was to try to do something about these large disputes and what happens to the money and doesn't happen about the money. But the more we dealt with it, the more we realized both the issues with the law, but more importantly, protecting the counties and the jurisdictions from any real risk in these dispute amounts. And so that's why we ended up with this particular mechanism versus the other. And so understand, it doesn't change a lot of things, but it does change where the money resides that's in dispute in these large disputes during the time of the dispute is. And so the companies are required to pay their taxes in whatever the disputed amount is. And then the counties hold that, and the counties hold the disputed amount rather than distributing that to the local governments and those that they would normally distribute property tax to. They hold that disputed amount in this account, and state and the county treasurers or others hold it in that account until the dispute is resolved. At the time the dispute is resolved, if the company gets all the money back, they get the money back with whatever the interest is accrued at that time. If they only get part of the money back, they get that money back, but then the jurisdictions get the other part of that, and the county assessors would distribute that. So from my standpoint, the important part of this aspect is just the payment of those taxes up front and where those monies reside over the course of the time it might take to resolve the particular interest. And so that's why we brought this forward. I don't think there's did a good job of explaining what the deal does, and Doug and Diane here can provide a little bit more testimony, but that's essentially the change in what the bill does.
Chair House, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'm testifying today on behalf of the Oregon State Association of County Assessors. I believe there is a side-by-side comparison that I submitted for testimony last week. If you could bring that up, I'll get to that in just a minute. The intent of the original deferred billing credit bill and this potential refund credit bill is basically to protect taxing districts from large refunds in 1 year, a single year, when a large value appeal is finalized. So that's the intent of both of these bills, the original law and the bill. Assessors were originally opposed to this bill because we felt that the law was doing what it was supposed to be doing and protecting taxing districts. But there was concern from the proponents that the appearance of the large companies not paying their taxes and using that deferred tax as a interest-free loan. So there was legislation brought forward on the House side that would have started charging interest on those deferred taxes, and then it changed to an interest that was a variable interest based on the income tax interest rate. And at that point, the assessors suggested that maybe a simpler way to do it would be to have the companies pay the taxes, and we hold that disputed amount in an account that is administered by the county treasurers. So that would resolve a couple of the issues of the taxpayer not paying the taxes, having to be deferred, and then having to pay them later. So that's where this bill came from. It's important to remember a couple things. The taxpayer does not have any say in whether or not they go under this provision. It is strictly up to the assessor as a risk management tool for the districts. Okay, and you may have been reading in the paper. There's the Comcast appeal and the $150 million in taxes that have been deferred. I'm not sure where that number actually came from, but it's a substantial amount of taxes that have been deferred. And if the districts had to pay that with the interest of 12% on a refund, it could be devastating to some districts if they had to do that all in 1 year. So this came about back in 2011 with the joint work of the Association of Oregon Counties and some taxing districts to come up with a way to help mitigate that loss. When we saw that some of these large communications companies, once they were taken over by the Department of Revenue, were going to appeal. The original bill would have cost the taxpayer interest on that if they had to pay additional tax. Because they didn't have a say in going under that, we felt that was not appropriate. And under this bill, they will, if they have to pay additional tax at the end when this is resolved, which I was trying to think about this after I talked with Mr. Robinson last night, the only way I believe there would be additional tax owing on a property would be as if the courts raised the value. Because under this bill, we would collect the full amount of the tax, just like any other taxpayer that goes under appeal. We'd collect the full amount of the tax. We'd put the disputed amount into a credit account. So when the case is resolved, they've already paid the full amount of the tax on the value, even that's under dispute. So to have additional taxes come in, the court would have to raise the value on that property. And under current statute, if an appeal creates additional tax, the taxpayer has till the 16th of the month following when the notification is sent to them to pay that additional tax by the assessor, to pay it without any additional interest. So if we sent a notice out that they owed additional tax in, you know, June 15th, they have until July 16th to pay that in full without any additional tax accruing. Then after that, it's just like any other additional tax. They'd have to pay the 12%. I do want to go real quickly through the side-by-side. The assessor, there's an appeal filed. The assessor makes a determination of what the disputed value and disputed tax would be. That's the same under both the current law and this bill. The difference comes in when instead of modifying the tax bill that doesn't make the taxpayer pay that disputed tax, they pay it and that disputed tax is placed into an account. So instead of not paying the tax up front, they now pay the tax up front. And then when the case is resolved, instead of the taxpayer paying the disputed taxes, if the county or the Department of Revenue would win, then they just wouldn't get the money back. It would be distributed back to the taxing districts based out of that reserve account.
And what if the county loses?
If the county loses, then the money that's held in that credit account that was paid by the taxpayer would go back to the taxpayer with whatever interest that was earned off of that credit account. And because it is a very safe account, and the county treasurers do this now with other funds, it's like a 1% or less. It's minimal. The taxpayer would get the amount of the refund back plus whatever interest that was accruing on that payment.
Whatever interest set by whom?
It is, they can either put it into an interest-bearing account. There is a pool out there, and Diane Bell can talk about this a little more, that counties can invest money in that goes through the Oregon treasurer, okay? And that is, there's a name.
Local investment
pool. And they do that all the time. Some counties, there's a threshold on that. Some counties are above that, and they have their own investment management people to handle this. So it's in mechanisms that the state treasurer has set up for safe investments for those types of funds.
Okay.
I'll let, if you have any questions, obviously I'll try and answer them.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Diane Belt, and I represent the Oregon Association of County Tax Collectors. I think everybody pretty much has given you a really good explanation of what this proposal will do. I can tell you, as tax collectors, administratively, this process is a lot easier for us to administer and manage. Currently, when we have a deferred billing credit come to us from the assessor, we have to actually split the amount on the tax roll, so we're forcing it to do something that it doesn't like to do. So it is difficult to manage because we have to hold those amount of taxes separate on the account, and then every year when your bill, you have to go back and adjust it again every year. This way the bills go out, the taxpayer gets a notice that it's under deferred billing. They make the payment, they get the discount. Currently, anybody who is going to appeal their value, in order to protect their discount, they need to pay it in full, even though they're appealing. So this isn't any different than what we currently do. What this does for the tax collector is it kind of puts it in a regular mode, in that the taxes are paid when the correction comes through. It goes through the process that we do for all corrections to the roll. The only difference is the money is being held by the treasurer. So at the time of the end of the appeal, and once all of the corrections have been made to the tax roll, either there's a refund that goes to the taxpayer, which would come out of that account plus the interest, or it will be distributed back to the taxing districts. I can tell you, when we look at the deferred billing credit, usually the tax collector and the assessor will sit down and talk about the appeal at hand, how much value's involved, their opinion as to how long is this going to take, because sometimes it just doesn't make sense to do it. If it's going to be something that's going to be determined in the next, 18 months, it's not worth going through this process. So we're trying to find those that are going to harm the districts, because it could go on for a lengthy period of time. And that's why this makes a lot more sense probably than what we did in 2011. But at that time, I think it was late in the session. I believe that a lot of the districts and assessor and tax collectors realize, and it's the Comcast case, that's the big one, that this was going to go on and potentially could be very harmful to the taxing districts. And so the process that we currently have is what we all decided on. We've been administering it. It works. This works better. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those.
Yes. We're talking just about large commercial properties here. What's the process for a residential homeowner who appeals it and says, no, you messed up, I don't owe this? I've appealed my taxes. I mean, what's the deal with what if I win? What's the process there?
Right. Chair Haas, members of the committee, this is geared towards value disputes of $1 million or more. If the value of the property is $1 million or more and they appeal, then this can be used. Or if it's a centrally assessed property by the Department of Revenue, then the assessor can decide to place a property under this program regardless of the value if they believe that the there's risk to the counties, to the districts. So if it's a county appraised property, it has to be $1 million or more. It doesn't have to be centrally assessed. It could be, we typically look at these for industrial properties, large commercial properties. I don't believe this has ever been used on a residential property. Part of the reason is residential properties tend to be resolved fairly quickly, within a year or two, where commercial properties can and centrally assessed properties can take longer, and that's where the risk comes in, is the longer the appeal goes, the greater the risk of the interest accruing that is in addition to the refund amount. So typically, if you had a house that was $5 million, you could probably use, the county could probably use this. But normal homeowners, no. They don't meet the criteria to fall under this, okay, so either the current law or the bill.
Thank you. How prevalent is this? What, how often is this? Take Comcast aside, how often does this come up?
Chair Hass, members of the committee, I haven't polled the assessors, but I know of maybe two other. I think one county used it on a large golf course that was a fairly large appeal. And then I think Mr. Robinson was mentioning that there was a property out of Linn County that, that it had this used on it. So other than the communications company right now, this isn't used a lot, but it is a tool that can be used. It's just not used. And again, I want to primarily, some of, even a large commercial industrial property will tend to be resolved within a, even a 3 to 4 year period. And it's, again, the assessor has to weigh the risks of, to the districts, and it may not just, it may not be worth it to them to do this if the treasurer and the tax collector and the assessor believes that the districts can absorb the refund if the case is lost.
Other questions of this panel? Senator Bircher.
Real quick. If you use a state banking system, the local government pool, there's a fee that, that has to be paid. Do we need language in this bill to who pays that fee?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rushiger, I also yeah, there's a fee. There's also a limit as to how much money that can be put in there. So, I mean, I'm looking at like Multnomah and Washington County, our Comcast appeal exceeds the limit that can go into the government pool. So there'll probably be a different format for or where they're going to put that money. And there's a fee for that as well. And I believe the treasurers would pull that out before they distribute the money. It's nominal. It's not a huge fee. But they would pull that, their expense out before they distribute the funds with the interest.
I guess my question is, Mr. Chair, do we need language? Are they going to dispute the fees now?
You know, they already do this process. For a lot of other things besides, you know, the actually we have a process with bankruptcy fees that go to, that we withhold from the taxing districts to pay for attorney fees. That goes into a special account. And if the treasurer has any fees, it comes out of that first. And there's, to my knowledge, there's no language that addresses the fee for that particular process. And this is a lot like that. We're going to distribute the funds when we get the deferred billing credit as the tax collector. We're going to distribute to the districts and to that fund so the money sits there. I know fees, I do know that fees were discussed. Yes. Because, yeah, there's a fee for everything that happens through the banks.
Where were you?
Yeah. Surprise.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you, Rip Lively. Chris Robinson, J.L. Wilson.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chris Robinson. I'm an attorney in Lake Oswego. My firm specializes in property tax valuation disputes. Been doing it for over 30 years, and I'm here to speak in opposition to House Bill 2407. I think the current bill or current statute works as intended, and Mr. Schmidt testified to that effect at the first hearing on the House side, and they were actually at that time in opposition to 2407. With the amendments now, I understand they're more or less neutral. But here are the big changes, and there are big. First of all, a $1 million valuation dispute is a very low threshold. Virtually all the appeals that we file at the tax court involve many millions of dollars in dispute. So our concern is that in trying to deal with the Comcast situation, you're going to sweep almost all large commercial appeals, industrial appeals, so we're talking strip centers, shopping centers, apartments. And the reason that we think that the usage of the deferred billing credit will be expanded is now the county has the taxpayers' money. So why wouldn't they opt in every case over $1 million in dispute? Why would they not opt to use this? So instead of paying 12% interest on refunds, the taxpayer on the disputed amount would get, according to I talked to Mr. Garst from the Department of Revenue yesterday, and he said that it might be something like 0.5%. That's simply not fair. The current system is, if you're delinquent, you pay 16%, taxpayer pays 16% interest. And the department is very protective of that 16% because 4% of that goes to the appraiser education fund. So this issue has come up before. There's been attempts to reduce the interest rate on refunds, but the department didn't want the issue of their 16% to come into the fray, so those previous legislative initiatives didn't go anywhere. So this would change the litigation calculus quite a bit. Because the 12% interest acts as a motivator for the counties to efficiently resolve appeals. Now, we do settle a good number of our cases, but still, it's not unusual for a case to last 1 year. We have currently pending cases that are 3 years old. But we're not the Comcast. We're not talking about, $150 million in deferred tax. Under the current system, it's discretionary with the assessor, and they issue either a credit, or in one of my cases, they actually issued a tentative refund. But if you change this and you pass this bill with its amendments or amend the statute, it's just going to have very broad implications that I don't think really are intended. And I know that one of the sponsors or proponents of this bill is a tax fairness organization. And I would ask you, is it fair to have the taxpayer lose 12% in virtually all large appeals and be paid during the dispute, during the litigation, if they're successful, 0.5%? It just seems very, very one-sided. So I think you have this motivation factor. You have the testimony of Mr. Schmidt that on the House side that the current bill was working, and I think it was working. But the $1 million threshold is very, very low, and with the county now having the funds, is just from just a logical perspective, why would they not expand the usage of the deferred billing credit to almost all appeals? So I should point out, also a member of NAOP and a member of AOI. AOI, I'll let JL speak, but is also in opposition to this bill. I've talked to members of NAOP. They own or manage large commercial and industrial properties. They're very, very concerned about this bill as well. So thank you, and if you have any questions, be glad to address them.
All right, we'll go to jail first.
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. Just for the record, Associated Oregon Industries does continue to oppose the bill. We do recognize that it has come a long way, but Chris articulated our concerns, and we continue to oppose.
Questions? Okay. Thank you both.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gil Riddell and Wendy Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gil Riddell, Association of Oregon Counties. I thought I'd fill in a little bit of history on this process. You did learn today that it started in 2011. It was a product of a work group that AOC pulled together with stakeholding taxing districts about how to deal with unexpected, unbudgeted, and expensive appeals of industrial properties centrally assessed properties. The deferred billing credit came out of that. And one thing that we did not discuss, though, was the multi-year extended appeal that goes on and on. And, of course, the primary example of that is Comcast. The interesting thing that I find about the opposition as stated is the bill offers a procedure endorsed by the Council of State Taxation, which represents nearly 600 multi-state taxpayer corporations. And so we took that endorsed idea and put it in here. The idea is to remove the incentive to push the appraisal or the appeal one way or the other. Just want it to be straight on and have it settled in the most fair way possible. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. The League also supports this bill. As Mr. Bedell explained, looking at our system, it's one-sided right now. It's very much in favor of the taxpayer because the taxpayer could lose on appeal for years and years of litigation, just have 30 days to pay, and they owe no interest even though they've lost this case, and they still get their 3% discount as well. Nothing to the local governments, school districts, counties, cities, even though this litigation has cost the taxpayer or the local government so much money. There's just no risk at all except for the lawyer fees. And when the amount in dispute is it's so much, it's actually less cost to pay the lawyer fees than that they would have had to pay if there was interest involved and such. So while every other appeal, you have to pay your tax to get your 3% discount, and there'll be interest if you lose, the present law is there's no interest. You still get your 3% discount. There's absolutely no risk. And so this bill shifts it back to fairness again. And in fact, as Gil explained, it is the recommendation of cost, the Council on State Taxation, to do exactly what this bill does, which is an escrow account that takes the disputed amount and puts it into an account, and whichever side wins gets that interest. And that's straight up what the recommendation is either cost recommendation is to not take the disputed amount or to put it in an escrow account. And so that's what this bill does, is shift that fairness back. $1 million perhaps can be argued to be a low threshold in some counties and cities, but for many, $1 million, take Curry County, Douglas County, that is a huge amount of money in dispute. And so it's purposely set that there. If the county assessor is that confident, they won't use this method. They'll continue to do the appeal and not put it in this deferred status. As has been explained, this has not been used that often now. Instead, they use the regular method with refunds. So we think it's the right balance. It sends the message that we're going to do this fair and not have these appeals drag out with no risk. So for those reasons, we support the bill.
Questions? What about the criticism that was brought up here just before you of the fairness aspect? And there's, you know, the layered, the 16% delinquent, and that. How do you respond to that criticism of this bill?
Well, Mr. Chair, it seems to me the refund will come back if the dispute falls in favor of the taxpayer. The interest is a matter of policy for you. This seems to balance out the risk that you have on either side and takes out the calculation of the interest as a product of the appeal. The appeal then is more focused on the appraisal as opposed to other factors of profit or attorney fees or whatever can be added on to that appraisal.
Okay. Thank you both.
All right, thank you.
Jody Weiser.
Chair Hass and members of the committee, I'm Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. Currently, if you appeal a large tax bill, you get to continue using that money. You can, and you continue using it for as long as the appeal's in place. And at this point, we have some appeals that have been going on for 5 to 10 years. Meanwhile, when the money finally does come to the taxing jurisdictions, if it does, it will not have any increase for the fact that the money is a dollar 10 years later is not worth what it was when the taxes were filed. So it really is a bill that's attempting to level the playing field. And I think that the mechanism that is in this version of the bill is an excellent mechanism. If it had been in place, if it had been what we passed in 2011, there would never have been any question about the procedure. It makes perfect sense. The currently, if you appeal your taxes and you get to keep using them, then you're not going to earn any interest. You're not going to get any interest from the local jurisdictions because they don't have the use of the money. You do. And we estimate, for instance, that Comcast is making probably over $4 million a year by keeping their taxes in the courts at this point in time. It's a nice profit center. It's probably not their intention, but the way the system works, it works that way. And meanwhile, the local jurisdictions who might have used the money to improve a park or educate a child don't have the money to do that. And so this gets the playing field even so that the appealing your taxes is not a money-making proposition in any way.
Thank you. Thank you.
Chair Hobbs, one of the points made by Mr.
We're fine. So it works different here than courts, I'm sorry. And we just had that rule throughout. I just want to say about this bill, I do appreciate the changes that were made from the original bill. I know a lot of work has gone into that, particularly from Mr. Schmidt and the assessors. I think because of those changes, there's been a reasonable compromise on this issue that I think needs to be fixed from the 2011 statute. So we are in a work session, Senator Bertschinger.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2407 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Bertschinger moves House Bill 2407 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bertschinger.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Chair Hass.
Hass votes aye. House Bill 2407 goes to the floor of the Oregon Senate with a due pass recommendation, and I'll be the carrier. And I'll close out that work session. We'll move on down the list here. We'll stay on property taxes and open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 2760.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2760 is, yes, it is property taxes, and it's it's a bill to extend the sunset for existing property tax exemption, the alternative energy systems, and it extend the sunset I guess, the standard, if you will, the standard 6 years. So you have the existing law sunset is July 1st, 2017, and that would move that out to July 1st, 2023. In the background of the SMS, I do describe what the alternative energy system is. So it's, and this isn't statute, it is a net metering facility or a piece of property that's primarily designed to offset on-site electricity use. And it does, the statute does describe the system. It can consist of solar, geothermal, wind, water, fuel cell, or methane gas energy systems. And really the key component here is that these would be systems that are affixed to the property that are designed to offset that on-site use at that property. So you could think of an example of just solar cells that are then using offsetting the use of the property's electricity. There could be some, certainly some electricity going back to the grid on occasion on the sunnier, the windier days, or when electricity usage is down at the property, but it's not designed primarily to be generating electricity to go back to the grid, but really to offset that on-site use. We do have the paperwork on this one. The revenue impact, it's up there in Olas. By extending it out, it is about $3 million biennium up to $4 million in the 21-23, and that's just based upon the information we've received from county assessors on where we are today and what the revenue impact has been, and then extending those trends out.
Of property tax revenue?
Yes, this is property tax revenue, yeah.
Okay. Max Muller.
Good afternoon, Chair Helm and members of the committee. My name is Max Muller. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. Our association represents Oregon's solar industry. Since 1975, Oregon is exempted from property taxation, the additional value that comes from installing solar and other on-site alternative energy systems. And House Bill 2760 simply extends this law for six more years. About 1,400 properties took advantage of this property tax exemption in the last biennium. Its revenue impact is pretty small, but it's a long-standing policy, and it remains a key part of the value proposition that prompts homeowners to choose solar or other renewable energy options. Essentially, under this law, if you choose to install an on-site alternative energy system, your property continues to be taxed as if you hadn't. The principle is to remove increased property taxes as a disincentive for choosing an alternative energy device. One example of how this could be a disincentive, with current solar homes, residential solar system sizes, the solar panels might generate about $600 worth of energy savings for the home. But it's very well possible that if the value of the addition of the solar panels were added to the home's property taxes, that the property taxes could go up by $200 or $300. So the increased property taxes would eat into about a third or half of the value of the energy savings, and that would be a significant disincentive for installing alternative energy devices. So we think this is a key part of Oregon. This is a key policy among others in Oregon that are helping drive to the development of renewable energy in Oregon, and we ran it by most of the major property tax stakeholders, including the League of Oregon Cities, the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon Special Districts Association, and the Association of Oregon Assessors. None are opposed, and it's had lots of support in the House. So we urge you to support it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Questions of Max Muller. Senator Bertschinger.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I am still seriously hoping that there's a day, probably in the future, that we have a serious conversation about tax credits. However, since that day has not come, I will support this bill.
I'd like to congratulate you. We don't have anyone else signed up, and we have no opposition here. Max, thank you for testifying. I'm going to open up a work session into House Bill 2760.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2760 to the floor with a quick pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2760 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion?
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to go ahead and support this because I'm really in favor of renewable energy. It's really important. As you well know, I'm not real fond of tax credits because it pushes the cost of things into the future, and in this case, it coming from property taxes, it 40% of that comes out of the school fund. So I will be a yes, but like Senator Bershinger, I hope we have a conversation about how tax credits work in the future.
Thank you. Well, I guess my take on this one would be if you have a home and it's assessed at whatever the value is, and you want to do something that's generally accepted as good behavior by installing renewable energy on your home, then I don't think that value should be added onto your home, and therefore making it less economically attractive, so that would create that behavior. And then all of this, so now you're right back to where you started with that value. So I see some redeeming value.
Does that hold with electric vehicles as well?
Different planet. But it's a good discussion. Both of your points are valid. Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hess. I was just going to concur with what you said to support. I support what your argument there. So,
clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bershinger.
Yes.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Certainly.
Hass votes aye. House Bill 2760 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Taylor, would you carry this?
Happily, thank you.
Okay. Close out our work session on that measure, bringing us to House Bill 3453. I'll open up a public hearing and work session on House Bill 3453.
Okay, Mr. Chair, continue with the theme of property tax today. House Bill 3453 is making modifications to two statutes that are regarding property tax exemption, and it's really about exemptions and how property that's being leased by an exempt owner can qualify for that property tax exemption. So the two statutes in question, this is in the SMS as well, is 307.112 and 307.166, and it's about if you have I guess use the example of a nonprofit entity, so an entity that can qualify for be an exempt entity under the property tax, and they're using the property for an exempt use, so maybe a charitable use, something the committee's familiar with. If you're leasing that property from a taxable owner, you can 307.112 provides authority for that, for an exemption to be extended to that property that's being leased. So the property is from a taxable owner, so in its initial stage it's taxable, but once it's leased to an exempt entity and used for exempt use, it can become exempt. The second statute there, 307.166, is for, in the same case, using the same example, a nonprofit entity. In this case, would be leasing a piece of property from a different nonprofit that's already exempt. So you have the property that's exempt right now, and it continues to maintain that exempt status if it's leased to another exempt entity and still used in that exempt use. So the changes in 3453 to those two statutes are about the language of ensuring that the value of the property tax exemption, so the difference between what the property taxes would be paid if they were owed and the fact they're not because they're exempt, it's requiring that to nearer to the nonprofit, to keep with that example, that's leasing the property. So under existing statute, there's requirements right now to ensure that the savings, if you will, from the property tax exemption are contained in the lease. So the lease would be set at a certain value that's reflective below market value of the savings of the property taxes. The House Bill 3453 would change that and not require it necessarily to be contained within the actual lease dollar amount, but rather just to make sure that those savings do go to the nonprofit, in this case, that would be leasing the property. So the savings don't have to go there. It just doesn't have to be reflective in a below market rent. And I think you'll have some testimony on examples of how that exactly would work, because it still could be part of the lease agreement. But it wouldn't be required of the assessor to determine whether or not the organization that's leasing the property is actually leasing it for below market rent. The revenue impact statement, it's a minimal. There could be, in some cases, we expect, because this is streamlining things a bit, a greater chance that a few exempt entities that are leasing this property may qualify that right now are unable to get the paperwork in order and such. But we wouldn't expect there to be much of an impact on property tax revenues.
Emily DeVries and Ken Antel.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nellie DeVries, and I'm here on behalf of the Building Owners and Managers Association. BOMA Oregon is a commercial real estate organization representing over 40 million square feet of commercial real estate in Oregon. We're here today in support of House Bill 3453, which essentially makes it easier for nonprofit organizations to take advantage of the tax exemption for when they're leasing property. We're not changing the property tax exemption in any way. It's just merely changing the language to make it easier to use. And with that, I'm going to introduce Ken Antel to let him be the certified expert on this.
Thank you, Nellie. Chair Haas, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak this morning. I'm a commercial real estate lawyer in Portland. I'm a partner at the firm Dunn Carney, so lots of what I do involves commercial leasing. So I deal with these statutes a lot. I think that what sort of the theme I would give you is that we are not attempting to change the focus or the intent. Go ahead, sorry.
Ken, identify yourself for the record, please.
I'm sorry. I'm Ken Antel from Dunn Carney.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, I forgot that part. What this bill does doesn't change what the legislature intended in passing the bills to start with way back in the I think it was the 80s. The intent, I think that staff correctly summarized the statutes. The intent of these statutes are to make sure that if a property tax exemption is granted as a result of a tenant being a tax-exempt organization, that tax savings inures only to the benefit of the tenant. In other words, you don't want a for-profit landlord to lease to a nonprofit tenant, get a property tax exemption as a result of that lease, and then keep that savings for itself. Right now, the current language of the statute says that you have to have this magic language in leases in order to take advantage of this tax exemption. And it has to say, both under both statutes, the statutes say in order to get this property tax exemption, the lease has to say that the rent has been set below market rent in order to recognize the property tax exemption. There are three reasons in my world that doesn't work, okay? Number one, when a lease is entered into, the parties don't know at that time if a property tax exemption is going to be granted as a result of the tenant's operations. Many nonprofit tenants do not qualify for property tax exemption. So you cannot, at the start of a lease, agree that the rent has been set below market because you don't know it's been set below market, because you can't do that because you have to wait and see if the property tax exemption is granted, which typically happens. You apply for it, I think, shortly after the first of the year, and it gets granted around April or so. So instead, what we want the statute to say is that to the extent it's granted, it's going to inure only to the benefit of the tenant, which is what the law which is what the purpose of the law was all along, and that's simply what we're trying to reinstate. The second reason it doesn't work is that many leases, particularly for retail space, are what's called triple net leases. You've probably heard that term, but basically what that means is that the tenant pays the rent, and in addition to paying the rent, they pay operating expenses and property taxes separately. They pay their share of those. So in that scenario, you would not set the rent below market because the rent is a separate component of what the tenant pays. They pay the property taxes separately, and if there's an exemption granted, they would simply be exempt from paying that property tax separately. But it wouldn't mean that the rent's been set below market. The third primary obstacle or reason that we would like to see this law change is because it simply presents confusion among both landlords and tenants that have to deal with it. Both parties sort of get to this statute and we go, okay, you're a nonprofit. In order for us to allow you to apply for this property tax exemption, we have to have this language that says that the rent's been set below market. And the tenant says, well, this rent isn't below market. This is our broker says this is what rent is at market. And so because of that, you have this twisted language where we try to make everybody happy by we'll say something like the rent is set below market to the extent that a property tax exemption is granted in the future, which shall inure solely to the benefit of the tenant. So we try to make it fit, but it just doesn't fit. So all this bill does is simply say what was the intent all along, and that is any property tax exemption that is granted as a result of this tenant's being a tax-exempt organization inures solely to the benefit of the tenant, which is what everybody wants anyway. So we're just trying to make life easier for those of us who deal with these statutes daily.
Questions for this panel? Senator Bertschinger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm still not comfortable with this bill. I think it still needs a little more work. Nonprofit status, I think, is being abused in this state, and we have to be very careful as we go forward with granting tax exemptions or making it easier.
Well, you heard the questions. I think we're attempting a technical fix here to clarify language. Senator Bowles, did you have any questions?
No. When it comes to making the motion, we'll talk to the motion.
Okay. We have no one else signed up. Thank you both.
Thank you.
The assessors are in the record as neutral on this measure. And we're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3453 to the floor with a do pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 3453 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Discussion, Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, this is a technical fix, and the proponents of the bill, and I'm fine with that. I sort of echo actually conversations I've had with House members that are related to the sponsorship of this bill, and Senator Riley and I have been scratching our head for 18 months or 2 years now on this whole nonprofit, and Senator Bertschinger raises the issue, and it's my comments are, though this is a technical fix, this bill, I just need to, I think, state that at some point we're going to collide in the next 2 to 4 years, and the whole issue of nonprofit status, what they pay both in terms of straight taxation, property tax exemptions and everything else is going to have to be resolved because we cannot financially sustain the state at the present programs that we have. And so I would just point out that while this is a technical fix, I think the issue that Senator Riley and I have been struggling in, I don't know if we're going to find a solution, but we're probably going to have a crisis and have to find a solution, and every entity that's a nonprofit is going to have to pay some sort of share in the future. Thank you.
Further discussion? Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To follow up on Senator Boquist's statement, we have been struggling with this, and we have, as Senator Bertschinger pointed out, some nonprofits who are shouldn't be nonprofits, and we have a lot of work to do in that area. But again, this is a technical fix, and it does, I believe, follow the intent of the original law, so I will support it.
Thank you. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bertschinger.
No.
Senator Riley.
Aye.
Senator Taylor.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boquist.
Yes.
Chair Ass.
Ass votes aye. House Bill 3453 moves to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a do pass recommendation. Senator Riley, would you carry this?
Sure.
Close out the work session there. That completes our agenda today. It was a very educational day here. Among other things, we learned that cement is an ingredient in concrete, and they're not synonymous. So I always take.
I'm looking for those concrete shoes.
We will not meet tomorrow. The Joint Tax Credit Committee will not meet on Friday. The Joint Tax Committee will meet, but time undetermined for now. So.
We need for paperwork.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you. We are adjourned. Yeah.